Senate committee meeting together. It's 1:31. Today, we're going to have the Children's Justice Act Task Force presentation with us. At the end, I think we have SGR 6 we'll probably take a look at probably in the last half an hour, 20 minutes. So we have with us, I think, Jan Ruthedale mm-hmm. is the chair of the Justice Act Task Force. And Kathy Baldwin, doctor, excuse me, Baldwin-Johnson, sorry, and Tom Janildo. Jadidlo. Yeah, see, I knew I was going to mess that up. I'm sorry. I apologize.
That's what I tell people about my name.
Yeah, I know. So all I'd ask is go ahead and present what you have for us as a task force briefing. Introduce those members of your task force if they're here. Introduce yourself when you begin to speak. So who's going to take the lead?
I am.
Jan?
Mm-hmm.
You're up, Jan.
Okay, great. Well, Senator Coghill and Senator Dyson and Willikowski, thank you so much for having us here today. And I'm going to be speaking a little bit, and then I'm going to be turning this over. And I just wanted to give you an overview of the presentation. I'll be introducing the Alaska Task Force, CJA Task Force, briefly. And then I'll be turning it over to Dr. Kathy Baldwin-Johnson, who, by the way, she's the medical director of Alaska Cares in Anchorage in the Children's Place in Wasilla. And a medical doctor, if I didn't say that already. And then she'll be talking about the child maltreatment in Alaska and why it matters to all of us. She'll be turning it over to Tom Janildo, who's a private attorney in Anchorage representing parents and in children's cases. Yeah. Of course, you know, we'll have time for questions, but I mean, interrupt us as we go on as you please. But we timed it. If it's straight through, it will be well under 45 minutes. But
and my plan, Jen, is to go ahead and let them present the whole body, because when I looked at it, I could see questions arising along the way that kind of came out mm-hmm. towards the middle or end of the presentation. So I think that would be the best if we just let you breeze through it in your order. And then the questions that we linger on, we'll take up after. I think that's probably the best way to proceed.
Okay, great. So as far as we've presented before you, we thank you for letting us present to you last year the Senate Judiciary Committee, and for again having us this year. And I know a lot of you are familiar with what we do, and I don't want to take time to go into detail, especially because your handout has the pamphlet that tells a little bit about who we are. That one, yep. And then also, it may be a little repetitive of the pamphlet, but it goes into a little more detail, the overview of the Child Task Force, talking about our history, our mission, and the projects we have been working on in the last couple years. And then attached to that is the membership list. And I'd ask that the members of the task force stand up right now so you can see all of them. And do you want me to introduce them? Or
wouldn't be a bad idea.
Okay. Just,
and then welcome to the committee, but if you wouldn't mind, Jan.
Sure. Sure. We have Gail Garagus, and she's a district attorney in Fairbanks. We have Pam Karalunas, and she's the
Chapter coordinator
of the Alaska Children's Alliance. We have John Bioff, who's general counsel for Quirik Incorporated in Nome. Behind him is Travis Erickson, who is what's your title at OCS? Field administrator for the Office of Children's Services, and he's located in Anchorage. Next to him is Rob Wood, who is the title?
Deputy Director of Operations for Juvenile Justice.
So it's picking up Deputy Director of Operations for Juvenile Justice, and he also is located in Anchorage. And then we have Marcia Tandeski, she's a guardian ad litem for the Office of Public Advocacy, also located in Anchorage. And our newest member is Linda Carlson, and she is She works for the Anchorage School District, and your title?
Assistant Superintendent for Instructional Support.
So Assistant Superintendent for Instructional Support. And then Bradley Grigg at the back, and Bradley works, he works in the Department of Health and Social Services in the Division of Behavioral Health. And your title?
I'm the Children's Behavioral Specialist for the Division.
Children's Behavioral Health Specialist for the Division, just so the recording picks it up. And then finally, Richard Bloomquist is our coordinator, staff coordinator, and he works in the Juneau Central Office of Office of Children's Services.
Thank you. Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
And we have others on the task force in your membership list that couldn't make it today. But they are very much a part of our task force. Also in your packet, and I won't go into the details right now, but is some proposed legislation that we'll be talking about in our presentation and something called amendment to the proposed legislation. And then also there is a summary of the adverse childhood experiences, not to be confused with the other ACEs that you know. And of course, that's just more detailed background reading for kind of what Dr. Baldwin-Johnson is going to be talking with you today. And as you know, we've been presenting in one form or the other off and on for the last, I mean, I think about 10 years. I haven't actually counted it up. But for many years, we presented to the Children's Caucus that Senator Dyson created, I believe. And then more recently, we've been just coming directly to various health and social services and judiciary committees. And I wanted to again note that part of our mission is to make recommendations. And last year, we did propose some legislation to the Judiciary Committee, Senate Judiciary Committee, and it Liesl McGuire picked it up and turned it into picked some of it up, and it became part of SB 210, which we're very grateful for. We want to thank Senators Dyson and Wilikowski for co-sponsoring that, and it passed unanimously, I believe. So thank you again for that. So with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Baldwin-Johnson.
Thank you, Jan. So my role today is to give you an update about the most current information that we have about Alaskan children that are in danger. And the sources of information that I used were the State of Alaska Office of Children's Services statistics for 2012, which are posted on their website, the data that's posted on the Kids Count data collections for 2011 through 2012 for both the state of Alaska and for the entire nation, the Prevent Child Abuse America website, which has a publication that talks about, that's a brand new 2012 publication on the cost of child maltreatment in the United States. And as I said, this is very recent. I downloaded the most recent stuff I could find on Monday. So when we talk about all types of maltreatment, which includes both physical abuse, sexual abuse, neglect, and other forms of endangerment for children. In 2012, over 16,000 children in Alaska were reported victims of at least one type of maltreatment, which means about 44 children a day. About 25 of those were for neglect, 7 were for mental injury, and often exposure to domestic violence gets classed as mental injury, 5 for physical abuse, and 2 for in-home sexual abuse. So this is a gross underestimation because it doesn't include all of the episodes of out-of-home sexual abuse that are screened out that are not within the purview of the Office of Children's Services and go directly to law enforcement. And even law enforcement numbers are a gross underestimation because, as we know, many cases of child sexual abuse are not reported. Our overall statistics put us at 171% of the national average, which is a grim statistic. But the good news is this is actually improved from previous years. I know when I first started tracking this for many years, we were way, way above the national average, and at times we were at like 6 times the national average. So this actually is an improvement. The question is, what does this mean for us as Alaskans? And we certainly know there are consequences of child maltreatment. They may be physical or psychological or behavioral consequences. They can be short-term. They can be long-term. And we know that there are consequences throughout the lifespan. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. Some of the short-term health effects we see are certainly death. And in fact, about one out of five young Alaskan children, that is children up to the age of nine, that die related to maltreatment. And actually about three quarters of those are infants, so our most vulnerable members of our society. When we look at child and teen death overall in Alaska, we find that not only are rates of child and teen death far above the national average, the Alaska average is up in red compared to the national average below, but homicide continues to be about the fourth leading cause of death for Alaskan kids. And if we look at violent death of teens, which includes homicide, suicides, and accidents, again, in Alaska, we are above the national average. And this is especially concerning because we know that our rates of teen and young adult suicide are very high and way, way above the national average. This is all expensive for us. Child maltreatment is very expensive for us as a country and as a state. The costs can be direct costs in caring for children that may be injured. They may be indirect costs. They include the costs related to our child protection system, our criminal justice system, whether that's our juvenile justice system or our adult justice system. There's an impact on future earnings and productivity, and there are medical and mental health costs that can be short-term or long-term. And it's a significant chunk of change. It's estimated that this costs the country about $220 million a day, which adds up to $80 billion each year. Again, this is a significant sum of money. And I think it's important that we realize that this is a significant contributor to our rising health care costs overall in this country, which we are struggling to try to figure out how we're going to pay for. And I think one of the things that we need to look at is what as contributing factors to our rising costs of health care. And there was a landmark study that was done that was called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Studies. It was done as a collaboration between the Centers for Disease Control and Kaiser Permanente, which is a large health maintenance organization in California. The first publication that came out of this was called Turning Gold into Lead, because it talked about how you take young children who are healthy and full of promise, and then you end up exposing them to all of these toxic stressors and physical abuse and sexual abuse, and then we don't have the good outcomes that we expect. This study was had initially in the first wave over 17,000 participants. These were folks that were all employed because they had Kaiser Permanente as part of their health plan through their employer. It was a close to 50-50 split between men and women. The majority were white, the majority were middle-aged, and the majority at least had some college education. So these were folks that you don't usually think of as being a high-risk population. And they asked this group about things that happened to them when they were young, so up to the age of 18. Did they have a history of any kind of abuse, whether it was verbal or sexual or physical abuse? Did they have other kinds of family dysfunction? Was there substance abuse in the home? Was there violence in the home? Were one of their parents mentally ill? Were their parents divorced or separated? And then the second wave of the study also added various kinds of neglect. And they didn't ask how many times this happened to you. They asked, did any of these categories of things happen to you? And for each category that this person experienced, they received a score of 1. And so that means that watching your mom beat up got a score of 1 and was categorized the same as watching as being physically abused yourself. And there were some very interesting findings that came out of that. One of the things that they found was that actually bad things happen in childhood to a lot of folks. They, over a quarter of the folks reported that they had been victims of physical abuse, that there had been substance abuse in their home when they were growing up. Almost a quarter, their parents had divorced or separated. So these forms of stressors were very common. They found that actually only a little over a third of the study participants had never had any of these things happen to them when they were children. So that meant that almost two-thirds had. And 12.5% had had four or more categories of these kinds of experiences when they were children. And then they looked at their adult health. And what they found is that that ACE score correlated and integrated in a graded manner. That is, the higher the ACE score, the more likely people were to suffer from all of the most common ailments that we suffer as a society today in terms of chronic health problems. So, for example, smoking. Smoking clearly correlated. If you had a higher ACE score, you were much more likely to start smoking when you were young, to be smoking now, and to be a heavier smoker. You were much more likely to be an alcoholic if you had a higher ACE score. You were much more likely to have ever injected intravenous drugs with a high ACE score. People that had a higher ACE score, over half of them currently suffered from depression. And for those folks that had a very high ACE score, over a third of them had attempted suicide at some time during their lifetime. It correlated with obesity, so a BMI of greater than 35. We usually consider a BMI of, it's just a way of looking at height and weight in proportion.
Body mass.
It's body mass index. And so a BMI of 29 to 30 is considered to be overweight. At 31 to 35 is considered obese, and you get over 35 and it's considered morbid obesity. So this is not just people who are mildly overweight. It correlated with sedentary lifestyle, which I thought was a fascinating finding, that you were 26.6% of the people that had these higher ACE scores were couch potatoes. And so, you know, we need to try to figure out what these connections are. So in fact, when they looked at different kinds of chronic disease, they found links with any kind of cancer, links with stroke, with diabetes, with sleep problems, with liver disease, and they found a significant correlation with chronic lung disease that persisted even when they controlled for whether or not they'd ever been a smoker. And then they found this correlation with heart disease, which you may already know is the most common cause of death in both men and women in our country today. And there was a stronger relationship with the ACE score than there was for the things that we traditionally think of as risk factors for heart disease. So ACE score was a bigger predictor than hypertension or diabetes or a high cholesterol level. Everything that they looked at, they found a link. So they found a link with reproductive health, with other kinds of mental health problems, with autoimmune diseases, with breaking bones, with being a future victim, with being a future perpetrator of violence, and they even found correlations with work absenteeism and work productivity. And it's not just that study, you know, both before and after this very large landmark study, there have been other studies that really confirm what the ACE studies found. So this is just a sampling of now hundreds of research articles that are out there that child sexual abuse and child physical abuse correlates with all sorts of mental health disorders and substance abuse. Another 30-year prospective study that found a correlation between child physical and sexual abuse and risk of sexually transmitted infections as an adult. Another study that looked specifically at cancer and found a relationship between physical abuse and cancer, even when they adjusted for other risk factors for cancer like family history. Another study that was, a 30-year prospective study that followed a group of individuals and found that physical abuse predicted a higher BMI in adulthood, even when they controlled for other factors like underlying nutrition and family history. A study that looked at adolescent suicide attempts and found that children that had been physically abused were five times more likely to attempt suicide. Teenagers that had been sexually abused, three times more likely to attempt suicide. And I think this is especially critical to look at here in Alaska when we have such high rates of teen and young adult suicide. and studies that looked at future revictimization and not only revictimization by that particular child, but also revictimization of other people in the family. So close family and friends also were at higher risk of revictimization and correlations with methamphetamine use and dependence. So really, the interpretation of all of this is that we really need to look at adverse childhood experiences as being one of the most basic causes of not only health risk behaviors, but illness and disability and premature death, and our health care costs here in this country and in our state. So that really then the next questions are, you know, to try to figure out what to do with this information is, you know, why does this happen? And that's a big area of current research. It's probably multifactorial as to why these links occur. Some of it has to do with the fact that we know toxic stress affects how brain develops, how the brain wires itself, how the brain learns to respond to the environment. Some of it has to do with the effects of toxic stress on the immune system. Some of it may have to do with underlying genetics, but some of it, it appears, has to do with something called epigenetics, which is that we may carry the same gene risk, say for colon cancer, but you know, one of us may get it and one of us may not, and that has to do with how these genes are expressed. And they now are finding the impact of toxic stress on gene expression. The next question is, what do we do with this information? And I think, you know, it's very clear that when bad things happen to children, that means more bad things are going to happen in the future. They're going to happen in adulthood, and they're going to be bad things for us as a society. And where we have traditionally spent a lot of our time, whether it's in the child protection field, in the medical field, in the mental health field, in law enforcement, in our court system, is we're working up here at the top of the pyramid. And I think it's very clear that where we need to be trying to have an impact is down here before we get to this point. So that means we really need to be concentrating our efforts on prevention, and we need to be concentrating our efforts on trying to figure out how to have earlier and better interventions. And in some case, you know, in some cases, those interventions have to do with having a better legal system that protects children from future harm. So we do have some legislative types of recommendations for you. The first is that we're recommending support for some increased support for child advocacy centers in Alaska. Federal funding for CACs for the state actually started in 2001, and then in 2008, the state took over the funding to help support CACs. And I think the three of you are pretty familiar with child advocacy centers, but just a reminder that they're child-focused, child-friendly, they're neutral, they're community-based, they're multidisciplinary, and the agencies bring their services to the child instead of the child having to go from place to place to place. They provide a forensic interview and medical evaluation, and those are done by people that are specially trained to do them. They do provide a psychosocial evaluation of the child to see what the needs are for the child. They provide either directly or by referral mental health services and advocacy and support for the child and family, referral for services that the family may need to be more successful at protecting their children in the future. They help coordinate the agencies for all of this to happen. And then they do data collection, and they track these cases over time to see what the outcomes are. We now, I'm very happy to report, have 10 CACs in Alaska with two satellites. And the CACs have served over 18,000 Alaskan children since the first CAC first opened in 1996. The funding since 2008 has been essentially flat, despite the fact that many CACs have had a significant increase in utilization, and most of the CACs have increased the kind of services they provide. And probably a good example of that is many CACs have really expanded their capacity to provide mental health services to children and their non-offending caregivers. So the CACs had submitted a request for a little over $520,000, and what's currently allocated in the governor's budget is a $400,000 increase, and so we're certainly asking for support for that. The other thing that we're asking for your support for is House Bill 73 or Senate Bill 22. This came from the governor's office. There are many provisions in there that will benefit children that have to do with sex trafficking, with investigations, with child abuse images, with some sentencing provisions about child sexual exploitation, some expanded admission of evidence of prior bad acts, and some revisions to our mandatory reporting statute.
So, Doctor, that's before the committee as we speak, and so I hope you're watching its iterations. The expectation for this committee is to have it before us again Monday to begin the discussion on probably a proposed new CS based on what you heard from the Department of, Public Defender and the ACLU gave some testimony. I think based on some of the things the department heard here, they're going to go back, look at it, and bring us a CS. That's when the modification begins in earnest, I think. So, and that'll happen starting Monday, and then Friday we'll take another look at it. So it's a work in progress, but I'm expecting, and I told my committee members, we intend to work it thoroughly, but not delay it. Is, you know, so we want to be very forthright, but deliberate, but not slow. So we're going to be working on it.
Thank you. Our legislative subcommittee will certainly continue to track and follow that.
Now I begin. Okay.
Just to identify yourself.
Again, this is Tom Janidlo. I'm a private attorney in Anchorage. The majority of my practice has been, up until recently, when I'm semi-retired, has been representing parents whose children have been removed by these guys, by OCS. And but my representation has been, you know, for families and the children, and hopefully for reunification. So what, you know, my approach has been from that. But we all agree on what we need to do. As a task force, our mission is to look at what we have before our state now, what the problems are, and trying to recommend some improvements. And here's what we're recommending to further protect our children. Number one, we want to update the current statute evaluating certain medical evaluations of suspected child abuse. And I'm going to turn it back to Kathy for this.
All right. And, Doctor, just for those recording us, if you could just say your name again.
Sure.
So they can put it
in. This is Dr. Kathy Baldwin-Johnson. So our current law, AS 4717-064, says that if there's reasonable cause to suspect a child has suffered physical harm as a result of abuse or neglect, then OCS or practitioner of the healing arts may, without permission of the parents, take or have taken photographs of the injuries, and if medically indicated, have a medical or radiological examination. And there is a provision in there that the parents must be notified as soon as possible. And this goes into effect when parents are not available or if a parent is refusing to cooperate in the medical evaluation of their child who's been brought in with an injury. The problem with that is that that present law isn't really current with regard to diagnostic testing. So it says basically x-rays and photos, and there are a number of newer technologies that are there that are more accurate, sometimes less invasive, and that do a better job, other than just x-rays, of helping us to differentiate between abuse and non-abuse conditions. Our recommendation is to modernize it, and it's just a very small wording change, instead of just saying radiologic studies, to say imaging studies or other diagnostic testing. Again, just to allow for that situation for healthcare providers.
So, Doctor, just for what it's worth, I think in the packet that you gave each one of us, there is a CJATF proposed legislative changes.
And that's in Section 5.
And it would be Section 5 of this. Thank you.
And certainly to continue the law the way that it's currently written, which requires parent notification of that testing that's been done.
Okay. Again, this is Tom Janidlo. Returning back. Second recommendation is that to add a new section to the criminal code regarding children's exposure to domestic violence. Although that may be a reason for the state to be involved in taking children in custody because of a risk of harm there, it's not a crime at this point in time. Although the municipality of Anchorage does have it in the criminal code there as a crime, it's not a state crime. So, you know, parents, the perpetrator cannot be prosecuted. So we were asking that committee look at that because research has indicated it's one of those adverse childhood experiences, especially if they're exposed. So even within hearing of the domestic violence, it does cause harm to a child. So our solution then would be to
Janidlo.
Yes,
I think Senator Dyson has a question on this.
I'm sorry.
Explain to me why they can't be first prosecuted under municipal law.
Well, they can under municipal law, but it's not a crime under state law.
Yeah.
So, but if it occurs in Wasilla, no, you know, can't do anything. If it occurs in Fairbanks, they can't do anything. It's only in Anchorage.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Recommendation number three is add some victim protections to the criminal law and the child protection laws, or as we call the child need of aid laws. First of all, in the discovery process, in both the criminal and the child unit of aid areas, the defense has access to all the information that the state has, and that's, you know, that is part of the legal process, and that's, they have a right to have that, and nobody indicates they don't have a right to do that. Sometimes this discovery, especially with interviews of the children and their mental health records end up in the wrong hands. For instance, a parent will get this and they're so upset by what the state is doing because that they pass it on to their friends and they see this stuff and it's re-disclosure and re-victimizing the child from what they may have said. And some of you, even in interviews that have occurred through, have been found on YouTube, you know, which is just, you know, universally put out there, which re-victimizes the child, the victim, over and over and over again. But we find most abhorrent, I guess, basically, is sometimes forensic medical exam photos of children's genitalia who have suffered sexual abuse. I've been passed to inmates within a correctional system because they, you know, they're just used for their own satisfaction. And
Dr. Janidlo, I'll listen to your solution, but then I want to get back to the problem a little bit. So
okay,
as you go through, I want to kind of pick back up on how we got there.
So our solution then is to make unauthorized publication of a victim's protected material of a crime. Again, we're not saying that you can't have the defense doesn't have a right to have this information. They just can't republish it, can't pass it out to someone else.
Dr. Janidlo, Senator Dyson.
The last line there, it says protect mental health. Why doesn't it just say mental and physical health? Or why is it only mental health?
Different sections of the law. That's all.
Okay.
That's all.
So physical health is already.
Yes.
Yes.
I forgive.
Okay.
Go
ahead.
No problem. Okay. Okay. How do we step in and provide the help that's necessary from the very beginning and try to help as many families as possible? Our recommendation number four is to revise the mandatory reporting statute. Now, quite a few years ago, over half a century ago, you know, we first started, the federal government first started mandating reporting laws. You know, those professionals who come across instances of abuse and neglect were mandated to report. And by 67, all the states pretty much had some kind of mandatory reporting laws. And we've also had over the past 50 years lots of federal and state, you know, publicity campaigns letting people know what child abuse is, what child sexual abuse is, and what to look for. The current law makes the following mandatory reporters, practitioners of the healing arts, and that's a list of 29 different providers who fall under practitioners of the healing arts, school teachers and school administrators, law enforcement officers, child care providers, and those people, paid staff who worked in domestic violence shelters and drug abuse and alcohol shelters. And the standard for reporting is whether or not there is a reasonable cause to suspect that a child has suffered harm as a result of abuse or neglect. I know that you're fully aware of this because we've done this before, but we learned from yesterday that the committee didn't know what physical abuse, sexual abuse was, and we repeated it here. I'm not sure if I have to read that to you, but physical abuse and neglect are fully defined in the statute, and that should answer some of the questions. The problem, though, is that research shows that even with the mandatory reports we have now, almost every year we come across children falling through the cracks. I mean, certain people who should be required to report are not on the list of mandatory reporters. So, one of the solutions we have is, okay, let's start adding more people to the mandatory reporters. Then there's also, we have a laundry list, I guess, of people who should be on there. Almost every year or two, three, we probably need to add some more people on there. At a minimum, we're asking that the following be added, okay? First responders. Like firefighters and EMTs, they may be the first people in the house, who might have access to some information that that child within the home are being physically abused, sexually abused, or being neglected. But they're not required to report. Okay. Social service personnel are not required to report. Juvenile Justice, GALs, CASAs, they're involved in the system. They work with kids in abuse, but they're not required to report. Veterinarians and animal control officers. Mainly animal control officers are sometimes the first people in a home, and they're usually welcomed into the home by the families, much more so than social workers. Social workers, we don't want them in our house. But animal control officers do come in because people are concerned about their animals, maybe sometimes more so than their children. The first child abuse case was brought in 1874 under animal abuse cases.
Interesting.
Mary Ellen was the case back in New York. But so there is a connection too, and the ACEs study has found that children who have seen their animals being abused are often also being abused. Children who either they're abused or they turn out to be perpetrators themselves, abusers. Okay. Again, filling in the gaps. Clergy are not on the list. And clergy are often sometimes, they counseling families, they know what's going on in the household, they should have an obligation to report also. And we've had, over the past years, we've had this great scandal in our state of a clergy abuse falling through the cracks that resulted in lots of lawsuits and lots of money being spent where it could be spent elsewhere. Coaches, others providing instructions like music teachers and taekwondo instructors, whom the children trust, sometimes reveal things. They're not mandatory reporters. And other volunteers who come in regular contact with children, who gain the trust of children are often being told what's going on in the household. That's a way we fill in the gaps. We think it's we can keep adding to this laundry list and making sure that there are no more cracks to fall through. But we believe after looking through all this for a long time that the best solution is to make all of us, all adults, responsible for reporting. Anecdotally, we have found that about half the reports to DFYS right now, or OCS, excuse me, comes from mandatory reporters, and the other half comes from concerned citizens who see things. And, you know, we applaud those, but they're not, you know, right now they're not required to report. And again, they only report if they have reasonable cause to believe and suspect that a child is being abused. You know. Right now, a little over one-third of the states require all persons who have reasonable cause to believe to report to OCS or to the
department. Would you say it again?
Right now, currently, over one-third of the states in the United States have in their laws mandatory reporters and everybody else has to report too. So. Yes,
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I really appreciate what you're doing there. I don't want to interrupt the proceedings. Child abuse has been a huge issue for me. Forgive my cynicism, but I know divorce lawyers, you know, who regularly, you know, in order to prejudice the settlements and stuff, tell the client that they're representing, file a DV charge, you know, and or accuse your spouse of child abuse. And particularly with the child abuse thing, once that investigation gets started, you know, there's no way for the fraudulently accused victim to not be really hurt, significantly hurt by both the investigation and the stigmatization. And we got to protect those from that too. Well, maybe offline you can tell us how to do that.
Well, I can. I mean, having been defending those parents in both divorce cases and especially to talk about divorce cases, I've had many times the other party will make an accusation, you know, that the court stands back, doesn't make any decisions, lets the department file an investigation and file a report with the court. And if it's come out as a false report, you know, my client looks better than the other person, you know, doesn't. The person filing the false report, you know, is looked upon with the jaundiced eye by the court as being, you know, who's truthful, who's being more truthful. So, yes, it does happen. It happens all the time, you know. But the truth comes out. The truth comes out, you know, as best as possible. We're all humans, you know, we make mistakes. But allowing an investigation to take place, is very helpful, I guess. And through the divorces and stuff, we have custody investigators who do the same thing. They go out and investigate the families, and they talk to friends and relatives, so they know. So, but it's a problem that occurs, whether or not, you know, they have to report or not. Sometimes people do that. But you know, if we are all responsible, and here we have the list of 18 states plus the territory of Puerto Rico who have required that all the citizens report or mandatory or no, required reporters. Okay, just as a aside too, there are three more states that are currently going through the process of revising their reporting statute to possibly include all citizens as reporters. The fact that Alaska still has one of the highest rates of child abuse in the United States is disturbing, and you would think that hopefully knowing that and being aware of that, that we would take the lead and say, how do we stop that? How do we as citizens and how do we as legislators stop this this massive trauma to our children? You know, that looking at all the harm that comes through by the ACE study showed that there is a lot of trauma. So we should be the first to protect our children. So, summary of our recommendations are that we support increased funding for CACs. Again, over $500,000 was asked for, and unfortunately, the governor only put in $4,000 in the budget. But you know, they do need more because it's been a flat funding for a long time, and they do a lot of help in screening out cases and also helping the cases follow through to prosecution. They are very necessary in the process. Secondly, we recommend support for House Bill 73 and Senate Bill 22. We ask that the statute 4717-64 talk about the medical evaluations be changed to allow for updated use of MRIs and other ones, you know, and which are less harmful than the X-rays to our children. So that be modified. Five, we ask that the children be protected from further victimization by through the discovery process by not making it a crime to redistribute information received in the discovery process. And lastly, and most importantly, I think, make all Alaskans understand that they have a responsibility to report when they have a reasonable belief to suspect that a child has been abused or neglected. Again, we're looking for champions to actually, every Alaskan should be a champion for children, you know, but we need somebody to make that happen. So,
yeah. And I'm going to start off with a couple of questions, and thank you for the report. It's just always sobering to us as a committee of where we find ourselves in society generally, in Alaska particularly. And so the recommendation is going to be taken very seriously by this committee. But there's a couple questions I had on recommendation number three. You're talking about the discovery process.
Right.
And how does that happen that this kind of information gets out? And does this really, do we have to tighten this up so tight? You know, it was a surprise to me when you said that. I'm thinking, my.
Actually, could we have Gail Gergues
yes.
respond to that?
Because district attorney.
She's the district
attorney. Gail, why don't you come on up and just identify yourself. And if it's a brief answer, just stand right there. If not, sit down and take a seat. And
thank you, Senator.
Just Parker. Identify yourself. And
yeah. My name is Gail Gergues, and I'm with the district attorney's office in Fairbanks. Right now, discovery, which is the process whereby in cases, whether they're criminal or civil cases, requires that information has to be shared. And we're not arguing with that. Everybody has a due process right to know about the information against them. What's happening, though, is like when I give the information to the persons that are charged with sex crimes, I have to give them the copy of the DVD, and I'm giving it to their attorney. And I also have to give them a copy of all the medical records and the photographs. Don't have a problem with that. But what happens is counsel will often give copies of these sorts of things to their clients because their clients need to know what they're being accused of and what evidence is against them. What our concern is then when it gets out of the attorney's hand and it goes into the client's hand, the clients can do whatever they darn well please to do with it. And the consequences are is sometimes it gets distributed inappropriately. So what we would like is just to tighten that up. Yes, it still goes to the client. It still goes to the attorney. The attorney can still share it with the client, but they can't redistribute it unless they've gone to the court and they've said, we've got a good reason to do that. A good reason to redistribute it would be we want to hire an expert, and we want the expert to have a chance to look at this stuff. Nobody's going to have any heartburn with that. The court's going to allow it. But just to give it to the perpetrator who may have an unusual interest in it that we would rather not perpetuate and may wish to share it to their friends or invite people over to view it is what we're concerned about. And that's what this is attempting to do.
That helps me. I was just baffled that would happen, but I can understand their right to the information. But not the right to misuse it. And, so I understand that. Is there any questions from the committee? Otherwise, I'll keep talking. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I too want to thank you. I know many of you are volunteers, and you spend a lot of time on this. It's obvious we appreciate the input. It's very helpful. I want to talk a little bit, though, about the root. I mean, why is there so much child abuse in Alaska? I'd be curious to hear what your takes are on sort of the root causes of it here.
Just identify yourself.
Yeah, this I'm Dr. Kathy Baldwin Johnson. I think that, again, it's something that's multifactorial. I think for many Alaskans, there's historical trauma that goes back for, you know, a couple of hundred years with things that happened in our state. We have a lot of social isolation here in our state, and I think that's a big contributing factor. A number of other things have led to a lot of substance abuse, especially alcohol abuse, in our state. And when you end up with children that are alcohol affected because they had in utero exposure to alcohol, they in turn are at much higher risk for both becoming future victims and future perpetrators because they don't have impulse control. I think that's why, and when you have these sort of intergenerational problems, they build on each other, and I think that's what happened here in Alaska, is that we had things going on for generations, and it was this ripple effect. Again, the more bad things that happen, the more bad things will happen in the future. And that's why I so firmly believe we need to be starting at the bottom. It's not that the things that we do up at the top of the pyramid aren't important, but we really need to recognize that we're going to have much more cost-effective work if we're working at the bottom of the pyramid and working out, figuring out how to have better primary prevention, better early intervention, better support for families.
Senator Wilkowski.
And I appreciate that. Do you have any suggestions for us on, because I agree, you have to break the cycle. And one of the things that's been sort of a revelation for me, having a six-year-old, is all of a sudden you have this child, and it's like there's no user manual. You just sort of figure it out. So I'm just wondering, do you have thoughts on ways that we can break through some of these historical traumas, help parents out? It's hard as a government. You don't want to impose regulations, rules on parents, but at the same time, you can provide support. Any other suggestions for us on sort of how you, obviously alcohol abuse, I think that's a huge, huge issue. Drug abuse, huge, huge issue in this state and country. Other suggestions for us on maybe breaking that cycle?
I think there are actually a number of programs either currently in existence or programs that are in development that just need, I think, further support. And there are programs that really concentrate on, that look at prenatal care and early childhood development and ways to help parents be better parents to their very young children. I think trying to, work in, because I think many parents are, I'm speaking with my doctor hat on, I think many parents may be more amenable to making changes and to learning, because most parents who are new parents really want to be a good parent. They don't get up in the morning intending to beat their children or to do bad things that harm their children. So I think when we have an opportunity to teach parents parenting skills that maybe they didn't learn from their parents, our best time for that is going to be during pregnancy and when they have that very young child in their arms.
Matter of fact, Senator Wilkowski kind of fell into my question on your pyramid on disrupted neurodevelopment. It really is an intervention that is quite complex from what I hear. So is there a methodology that people use that is already in place under looking at that neurodevelopment at that kind of the baseline level you're talking about?
This is Dr. Kathy Baldwin Johnson. Senator Coghill, just to clarify, do you mean are there currently programs that are being that have evaluation already done, or
maybe that's a better way of saying it? Yes, thank you.
There are programs like the Nurse Family Partnership programs that actually do have some research behind them showing that their interventions work. There are some interventions that are based in primary care practices that have been done in other areas of the country that some of us are looking at are these things that we could introduce in Alaska?
Doctor, the reason I ask that is, being a part of the budget process for the Health and Social Services for the state of Alaska, we have continually asked the question, how do we do family-to-family interventions? How do we do support services for those who have little or no support? And so I was just wondering how, with the range of programs we have, that many times The program itself is good, but very narrow capacity. We have, so a lot of good ideas with kind of spot value, you know, spotty value. So I think, Jan, you had a question.
I did. Yes, thank you, Senator Coghill. This is Jan Rutherdale. I thought maybe this was a good opportunity, since you mentioned the budget committee, to give a shout-out of support for the governor's budget that has some modest increases. Well, we've already talked about the Children's Advocacy Center, and we are supportive of the other line item projects of having to do with increasing housing, I think, with domestic violence, you know, affected families. There's support to the Strengthen Families program that goes to Health and Social Services. And I think that one, I learned more about it this morning. That one was, I think, particularly interesting, because there seems to be a trend that it's sort of, you're working smarter with your dollars, your limited dollars, and so it's working with the parents first in a positive, it's not the, you know, punitive model, but actually let's build capacity, let's strengthen them, let's applaud the strengths they already have, and then build upon them, and it's working with agencies that are already in existence, but building teaching them different models of way to work with parents on that.
You bring up a good point, Jan, and mm-hmm. this goes to one of the recommendations on mandatory reporting. One of the things I get concerned about is that if we turn everybody into mandatory reporting, then we build edges that make people report on other rather than help each other. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just concerned that we create kind of the unintended consequence that people, either through misinformation or through deliberate improper action, there's a variety of different ways you create this tension that, you know, here you have a family already under stress, mm-hmm. and now they're going to be on everybody's report list, and it could have the unintended consequences of making them kind of get victimized by that on one hand, and not get the help on the other hand. And so I'm listening to the recommendation, trying to think, okay, how is this going to actually practically land as we make mandatory reporters who really are, they can be disinterested reporters and actually create, I think, what I consider more harm.
Well, one thing, and I, you know, if you need more detailed information, I'm sure Travis Erickson can from OCS can speak more on this, but you have to remember that that OCS has done a good job lately in creating a more tight intake process where they have very specialized and experienced workers, ones that have worked in the field, they understand the process, make it more centralized, and so the reports are being funneled to them. They have, you know, criteria to whether to even screen it in for investigation or just screen it out. And so, my understanding is that the ones that are screened out, they don't even report back to the family, like, you know, because it's screened out. It's like, you know, it's gone. And so really it's only the ones that are screened in for investigation, you know, the ones that are not spurious and rise to some level of, wow, we better take another look. And the hope is, sure, you may have that unintended consequence, and I totally understand what you're saying, the kid is further isolated or something because the parent figures out who the mandatory reporter is,
right,
or something,
right,
to that
exactly
effect.
Right.
Yeah,
that's one unintended consequence.
Right, but I think it's a question of balancing, and hopefully that won't happen, but if it does happen, you have to balance that against all the other reports of harm where there's really good that
sure.
can come.
And I understand that. Yeah. And so I'm thinking of myself as a father and now a grandfather of children, and I'm in the grocery store and I see something inappropriate. And, having a smartphone, I think to myself, who can I call? So that is a little bit of problematic. Do I call 911? who do I call then? And if I call somebody, what does that do? So there's kind of a reporting question mark, number one. And then secondly, if they actually do get through somebody, do I become involved in the system and I never get my life back? And so those are the two questions that kind of a normal human being is going to have to filter before they even pick up a phone, I think. Tom, I'm sorry. Everybody's a doctor in my view. Everybody's smarter than me.
Well, actually, you know, those of us who are attorneys are doctors, too. I guess, you know, we're looking at triage right now. And you know, hopefully at some point in time, we're going to get down where, you know, we have complete societal change and everybody is walking around.
Yes,
know,
sir.
Yeah,
agreed.
With a halo on their heads. You mentioned about being in a grocery store and something happening. You know, it may be, you know, take some courage, courageous, but going up to the person and saying, looks like you're having a bad day or something, just, you know, rather than calling somebody on them or saying,
stop that,
you know, just divert their attention from that so that, you know, maybe, you know, that, you know, that you gain a friend rather than, you know, an enemy. So it just acting like a social being and taking care of each other, I guess, is what we're...
No, and Tom, the point's well taken.
Yes.
But what we're going to consider, maybe, is we'll make people mandatory reporters. That has kind of the hard adversarial edge of the law. And so there's a responsibility. First of all, am I aware of the responsibility? And secondly, can I carry that responsibility out and still be a good neighbor? And those are the questions I'm asking as I look at this. So just as a guy trying to think, okay, if I make it a responsibility, how can they carry that out? And do I want them to be more helpful, or just is their responsibility only reporting? And even with the teachers, the pastors, coaches, all of those have been part of the problem and part of the solution, all of them.
Right.
And so then you have, you know, other problems on your hands. So there's a responsibility, number one, but many of them have failed in huge, huge detrimental ways. And but that's also true of us probably generally as a society. So I'm trying to think, how do I assign a responsibility like this with the expectation that it'll hit our society the way you just described?
Well, I think it's, again, this is Tom Janidlo. It's going to take some pretty good PSAs. Public service announcements to educate the public. We're not just going to, I don't think we would just pass law and say, you know, without people being aware of something happening like that. But again, the national campaign is that, you know, we are all responsible for all of our children, you know, not just my kids, but we are responsible for all of our children. That's something we need to promote.
That, you know, many of us grew up during the Cold War years, and during the Cold War years, heard of places in, you know, communist countries where people were mandatory to report on each other. I don't want to go down that road.
Yeah, no.
You know, so that's kind of that's one way deep end that I don't want to get involved in. But the other end is, how do I not chill the willingness to help somebody by putting a requirement on them that may very well do that? So it's just something I was thinking about as we go down that road. As you made the recommendation, that's how my first impression of that recommendation falls. Senator Dyson?
Yeah, I don't want to divert this, but I can't sit quiet and tell you how much I understand your concern, but I disagree. And this is the issue. Remember in the New York case, a woman was assaulted and raped by many guys and beaten to death? People walked by and didn't do anything. And that's, Tom's right.
Right.
We have a human responsibility to do it. And here, you know, I don't want to encourage people to not go to the rescue of a kid, you know, that we know this happened, a reasonable expectation, because we're afraid of what might happen to us. You know, when it's a child being hurt, you know, the risk, we know that not helping that child is going to have a huge thing. And we've got to put that child's welfare ahead of our own. I passed a bill here a few years ago that says if you see it happening, you got to do it. You're a mandatory reporter. It's a positive defense that you are afraid. You know, then you can pick up the phone, blow a whistle, you know, go hide behind the fence and call.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry.
His point is well taken, and I guess we would argue it when the paper gets in front of us. However, we're talking about suspected child abuse. We're talking about things that can be very subjective in their view to begin with, to the more obvious and detrimental things, no doubt. But I wanted to let you know, as us becoming the policymakers that would make everybody mandatory reporters, you begin to have those questions come rising up.
But again, like I said, they already report now, and even though they're not mandatory, they still do. If they have their own reasons to do so, either because they're concerned about the children or because they want to get somebody in trouble.
Points well taken. I think, Jan, you had something.
Yes, this is Jan Ritherdale. And I just, we've been talking about this a lot. We struggle with the same issues that you're struggling with. And obviously, you know, we can recommend what we feel is in the best interests of children. Mm-hmm. You might have a bigger picture to look for. And so we explored, you know, and that's why we had this is, from our perspective, best case scenario, but, you know, if reality's, here's an alternative, you know, here's additional professionals that we feel should be on the list. But also, we apologize because it didn't make your slide, it fell off the PowerPoint, but we did, if you look in the amendment to the legislature, we did put a provision that if you not just suspect, like I heard so-and-so say something, but if you see a child being sexually abused, so basically the Sandusky situation of, you know, I saw it, then, you know, any adult who's seeing that has an obligation to report. That's a baby step. So, you know, but it's sort of saying this is an area where it's the harm is just so huge that, so that's, you know, it's an alternative.
It's already there.
Yeah, and you brought some pretty good suggestions. We have many laws already that are similar to that, and now it's just a matter of looking, do they broadly describe what you want to get done, mm-hmm. as well as should be done. So thank you very much, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, I'm just going to make a quick comment, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. It's a great dialogue, great debate. I can see both sides of the reporting issue. I have constituents who've told me they've had been reported on, or they brought a child in who had bruises, and they got reported, and they had to deal with a whole bureaucratic nightmare after that. And so I can sort of see that side. I can see reporting being used offensively as a weapon against someone. I can also see the potential that it makes someone less likely to take their kid to a doctor if they're bruised or something. So I can see both sides of it. Certainly in the Sandusky case, though, that's a clear one in my mind. That needs to be reported. But just I just really want to emphasize, I greatly appreciate the recommendations you make, but I just can't help but think that by the time you're reporting the incident, or by the time you're urging the doctor to look at diagnostic testing or something like that, the incident's already happened. And so we need to deal with those situations, but I just can't emphasize enough, I think we need to go back further to really try to address the root cause. And I think, you know, just sort of figuring out where does everybody with a kid go is school. And so we got to figure out a way to get the education system involved, our public schools involved. And I think, you know, this year we're going to have a big debate on education. We have it every year. But I think we really need to, as a state, figure out what our goal for education is. Some people say, well, the goal is just to go down there and have kids do good in math and science, reading. I agree with that. But you also want to create good citizens. You also want to create good community members. You also want to create kids that don't grow up to beat up their kids. And so I think we need to do a better job working in our education system to teach our kids to break the cycle. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
You know, parents and pedagogy all have to happen simultaneously somehow. So I have one other bill, but you sure get the last say if you want to say anything before the committee.
This is Tom Schnidlow. It seems that it's very difficult to get money for prevention. You know, everybody wants to try and treat what they see in front of them as being the most important. And prevention is kind of like, well, maybe if this will happen, but you know, that's where we need to focus on. We need to get there somehow, some way. And you're right. And the earlier we start, the better society we're going to have, the better chance our kids are going to have.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. And for all of the members of the task force, you know, you have our deepest gratitude. We'll take these to heart. We'll start mulling them out as either a committee looking at it specifically, or as bills come through here, how we might look at them with these recommendations in view. So we'll not take it lightly.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And we're just going to take an at ease for just a moment while we settle up. Judiciary back. Now we're going to bring up before us the Senate Joint Resolution number 6, which has already been introduced to us by Senator Dyson, and we have some people who called in to testify, and I would like to get right to them unless the committee has something else to do. Okay. So we have one in Delta, one in Glen Allen, one in Kenai. If any of you have a time constraint, speak up right now. Which one? Glen Allen has a time constraint? All right. So, Bob Neely, are you able to speak up?
Press the mute button.
Bob, are you on a mute button? Mr. Neely, yeah, I'll give you an opportunity to chime in or reset your call. All right, let's go to Bryce Wrigley. Bryce, can you hear us?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, please state your name, affiliation, and testimony as you wish.
Very good, thank you. My name is Bryce Wrigley. I'm actually just testifying on behalf of myself at this time. And I just appreciate the opportunity to testify on this resolution. As our central government has become more powerful, all of us have seen different ways in which it's usurped the state's authorities, including the right to manage our own resources and educate our children. The states, for their part, have been willing to allow this incremental encroachment in return for federal highway dollars, welfare dollars, education dollars, etc. Part of the debate over the gun control measures and the Second Amendment is, why would anybody need an assault rifle or a large magazine for hunting or quiet enjoyment of the shooting sports? But the Second Amendment was not for the purpose of allowing hunting or skeet shooting. It was put in place to protect the citizens against those who take away their freedoms, including a day that when maybe a more powerful central government might attempt it. And this was clearly stated by George Washington when he said, a free people ought not only to be armed and disciplined, but they should have sufficient arms and ammunition to maintain a status of independence from any who might attempt to abuse them, which would include their own government. Many of the founding fathers echoed that sentiment. I just want to go on record as saying that I support this resolution, as I support any other efforts to take back any authorities and powers that the Constitution grants the member states of the Republic. However, to me, this wording seems pretty timid, sort of like Oliver asking, please, sir, may I have some more? I would prefer a more strongly worded resolve that demands rather than urges the Congress and the President. Fortunately, this is not a Republican or a Democrat issue in Alaska. It's a fundamental rights issue. And I would hope to see an amendment at some point that puts a little bit more teeth or fire and brimstone into the resolution. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Bryce. Appreciate it. I think the sponsor will take it to heart. And we actually have, I think, statutory law floating through the building that will actually make it heavier charges to enforce some of these things. So stay tuned. Thank you very much, Bryce, for your testimony. Any questions? All right. Thank you. Thank you, Bryce. I appreciate that very much. Is Mr. Neely online?
Yeah.
Mr. Neely, please state your name and affiliation and give us your testimony, please. Thank you.
My name is Bob Neely. I represent myself. I'm a Hockna Copper River Indian, Alaskan Indian. I'm a Vietnam Korea War veteran from 1968-1970. I was an American advisor in the jungles of Cameroon, West Africa, 1971-1972. And in my culture, you are not a man unless you own your own gun. And if we live off the land with our own gun, we can get food with our rifles, shotguns, and money. Money doesn't last long. And once it's gone, you don't have any food. So I'm for protecting the Second Amendment of the Constitution of the United States to the right to bear arms. That is my testimony.
Well, Mr. Neely, first of all, from the committee, thanks for your service to our country and your willingness to stand up and speak up. Thank you very much. Is there any questions from the committee at this point? Mr. Neely, thanks for your patience and your testimony.
You bet.
We got Scott Hammond from Kenai. Are you on, Scott?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott Hammond. I'm a lifelong Alaskan, over 50 years, and my family was one of the lucky ones that came up as a colonist in 1935 and got a lot of family here and was raised in the woods like a lot of us and grew up around guns and owned guns even before I was born, really, because they were bought and set aside for me. I really support this resolution I urge you to move it along. As we all know, we apparently seem to be under, I don't want to use the word attack, but maybe that is an appropriate word from Washington, D.C., in an effort to take our guns, and I really support anything that we can do as a people in the state of Alaska to say, no, we're not going to do that, and hopefully encourage other states to stand up and do the same thing, and really appreciate your time today to testify on this, and again, strongly support this resolution. Thank you.
Scott, we really appreciate you taking the time out to testify. I know your sentiments are felt by a lot of people, but I appreciate you articulating them very well. Thank you very much for your testimony. We did not have a long list of testifiers, so is there any discussion in the committee at this point? Mr. Dyson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we move Senate Joint Resolution Number 6 from committee with individual recommendations, and I believe it goes straight to rules.
And has attached fiscal note.
Is attached fiscal note.
All right. Any objection to moving Senate Joint Resolution Number 6? All right. Senate Joint Resolution Number 6 goes on to its next committee referral. Thank you very much. Stand by to sign the recommendation sheet. With that, we'll bring the committee to an end. Thank you very much. Adjourned.